From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. According to data released by the Centers for Disease Control earlier this year, one in 47 Utah children has autism, a condition characterized by impaired social skills and repetitive behaviors. Researchers at the University of Utah are searching for ways to change these deficits into strengths, and they think they're onto something. They've been training school-age kids with autism on a piece of software, and the results are encouraging. Friendships, bonds with siblings, and a sense of accomplishment. Today on the program, we're talking about the iStar Project and how technology may be the key to a productive life for those with autism. Plus, a chemistry in a top hat and tails. The annual Faraday lectures are here. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. A team of University of Utah researchers is focusing on how technology can help kids with autism develop social skills. And today on the program, we're learning more about the iStar Project and how working with the spatial visual strengths of children with autism can lead to more productive relationships. Joining me in studio is Dr. Cheryl Wright. She's an associate professor in the Department of Family and Consumer Studies at the University of Utah. She leads the iStar Research Project that focuses on creative, social, and computer skill development for children and youth with autism. And Dr. Wright joins me in studio. Good morning, Dr. Wright. Thank you so much for the time.
Sure.
Also with us, Dr. Scott Wright. He is an associate professor in the Gerontology Interdisciplinary Program at the University of Utah. He's also part of the iStar Project. And Dr. Scott Wright joins me in studio as well. And Dr. Scott Wright, welcome.
Good morning.
For simplification, you are married, and I'm going to call you by your first names if you don't mind. Otherwise,
that works.
We'll have a little bit of confusion here. I'm grateful for your time. Later on in the program, we'll hear about a tribute to the noted scientist Michael Faraday. But first, autism and technology. If you've got someone with autism in your life, what environments or tools have you found to connect with this person? What do you want to know about the link between computers and video games and interactivity socially? You can join our conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Cheryl, before we get into the specifics of the research, describe what autism spectrum disorder is and how it's diagnosed.
Okay. How it's diagnosed is a little bit more complicated.
What is
but
it first?
Autism is, I would say in general, is a disorder, a condition that at a core feature is communication. And so individuals on the autism spectrum have difficulty with nonverbal communication, communication in general, so that we're very interested in the social aspects, that these kids tend to be somewhat socially isolated because of the difficulty in communicating.
What got you thinking that technology may be a tool, a very effective tool, to help children with autism sort of connect with the world?
Mm-hmm. It all started with Google's Project Spectrum. That's sort of our foundation. And we have collaborators from Google who worked with us. Our project's been in existence for 3 years now. And it just started with a seminar that we offered in the Salt Lake community for parents and teachers. And from there, we started offering summer camps for kids. We've done after-school programming, and we also had a site school-based program.
Hmm. You are a professor of family and consumer studies. Scott, you're a professor of gerontology. How in the world is someone, before I read your study, mm-hmm. I was like, why is a gerontologist involved?
Right.
And tell us how you got roped into
sure.
this.
Well, it does seem like the connection or the bridge seems like a far one, because we associate autism spectrum disorders, we associate it with elementary, toddler, preschool ages, school age. And the notion of connecting it to the aging experience is something quite new. So I'll tell you about how it's connected in two ways. One is through the role of the grandparent, as an example, with our project. So this issue, which Cheryl was mentioning earlier about support or the way in which families are involved in our technology-based educational program, a lot of people would assume it's primarily one parent, possibly the mother, maybe the father. But what we have discovered with our iStar project, which uses SketchUp, which we can talk more about, is the main technology software program, is that it's really embedded in a intergenerational family support system. When we started off with our workshops, and I think it was basically Cheryl saying, Scott, you need to come check this out. There are a lot of grandparents who are the ones bringing their grandchildren to the workshops. They're the ones who are there during the whole time, interacting with their, in our case, typically a grandson. Most of the boys, it's typically all males in our workshop. We could talk more about those issues as well. But the grandparents, in terms of their active involvement, was something new. So that's the connection with gerontology. Number two is autism spectrum disorders is a lifelong challenge. So part of our iStar project, we have an interest in what happens to children who become adolescents, who transition to adulthood, then what happens to them. And that's where the research is really quite slim. And so I have a great interest in forming a part of this research team at starting as early as we can with childhood. And then we have an interest in this project supporting individuals across the entire life course. Mm.
Speaking with Dr. Scott Wright, he's an associate professor in the Gerontology Interdisciplinary Program at the University of Utah, also part of the iStar Project. Also with us, Dr. Cheryl Wright, associate professor in the Department of Family and Consumer Studies, and she's heading up the iStar Research Project. We are learning about iStar and the role that technology can play in helping children with autism disorder adjust, form relationships and friendships. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Let's let our listeners in on what this experiment actually entailed. Cheryl, tell us about the software. It's a tool you mentioned called SketchUp. For those who have not played around with this tool, what is the purpose of this software?
Okay, it is, first of all, it's freeware, and so anybody can download it for free, and which makes it particularly appealing to us because the services and the cost to families is quite high to get services for their children. And so SketchUp is a design program that is used by millions of professionals all across the world. And that can include architects and
urban engineers,
planners.
Theme park designers,
yes.
Use it?
I will say that our number one mentor, which makes our program, this is an exciting aspect of it, is a universal creative designer. And so he's the main person working with the kids. And he worked on the team that designed Harry Potter. Mm. So the kids.
Instant credentials,
yes,
with the
kids. Absolutely. Yeah. Bonded with him. Our kids are like, I could have a creative career. I could have a career where I work on computers. And I think, a lot of children on the autism spectrum have an affinity towards technology. Not all, but many of them do.
Can you tell us why? Do you know why?
We think, and there is some research to support this, that they have, not all kids on the spectrum have this, but spatial visual talents. And we've seen that. They love SketchUp, and, our joke is that within the first hour, they had all outpaced us that were working with them in this program. And so they create these really interesting designs. A lot of the kids spend a lot of time on computers. And I know you mentioned, you know, gaming. And what we really like about our program is this is a creative use of technology. Mm. They have to design things. They're making, you know, lots of projects. And one of the things that we found, that one of my favorite part about the project is that we have the kids present their designs at every workshop. And so they present to each other. And then we also provided opportunities for them to present to their families and family events. We even held a celebration of their work down here at the library in the auditorium one summer. And so, and then my favorite part of the project is we brought them into their own classrooms. Most of the kids that we're working with are verbal, and they also are mostly in regular ed classrooms. And so we provided support, brought them into their classrooms with their classmates, and had them present their SketchUp designs and teach their classmates about SketchUp. These children were amazing, and we think that, you know, Scott's here to talk about grandparents, but we do think it just put them in a different light than what their peers usually saw them in, and even their teachers.
Hmm. What were you expecting to find? So you get this a group of kids on the autism spectrum,
mm-hmm.
And they have particular skills. You present them with a software package, and it's presented by somebody who's really creative and knowledgeable. What were you hoping to find there?
You know, getting back to Google's Project Spectrum, and one of the long-term goals and one of the things we're very interested in is developing job skills. There tends to be a very high rate of unemployment with individuals on the autism spectrum. And so we thought, we're going to just teach these kids skills. You know, they're going to learn SketchUp. But soon we realized how powerful SketchUp was as a tool to facilitate social interaction. Some of my special ed colleagues were very concerned that, oh, one more computer program for these kids to fixate on. And it had just the opposite effect. They were able to communicate with each other, showing their designs. Parents were telling us on the, you know, after the workshop was over in the car, they were talking about the designs everybody did. Many of the parents said, oh, it was a way for me to really see inside my child's mind what's going on by his designs. And so the social aspect was unexpected, an unexpected finding. We have another paper that was published last year. But, you know, we think that's what's so exciting about the project is how it can facilitate. And with grandparents, you know, the kids can teach their grandparents SketchUp, but also show the grandparents their designs. And it became a tool of social engagement.
Hmm. At what point, Scott, during the experiment, did you start to notice that the kids were interacting with other people mm-hmm. in a different way than before the experiment started?
I think, you know, during the course of the very first workshop, it became evident that when using SketchUp, like Cheryl said, there was a fear that the computer terminal, the screen, would turn into this silo. It would just focus each child's attention. That would be it. But then we started noticing what we call peer-to-peer interactions among one another inside of our workshops. So we're talking about anywhere from 8 to 10 boys are at work on the computer, but they're also being mentored by a certified instructor who's going around helping. So there was peer-to-peer, and then like Cheryl mentioned, there was this dialogue, sharing, exchanging. What are you doing? Where did you get those creative ideas? How did you go to the internet? And so part of our research is to collect the data through observational data with video cameras to actually watch the detail of social interactions that go on inside these computer labs. But then here's the key part. What happens when the children, the youth, leave this computer setting? So they're carrying this momentum, this social engagement outside of the computer lab, back home with parents. Here's the other cool part, with siblings. So siblings who thought that their brother was just sort of like so different, didn't want to have anything to do with him. Here is their brother showing mastery, competency. And then, as Cheryl mentioned, the grandparents were reframing their complete outlook. And then you have to see the ripple effect so that the child carries this sense of mastery and self-esteem wherever they go. And we're very interested in how this sustains over a long period of time. So from a very simple computer freeware program is this unanticipated effect of social engagement plus learning a potential job skill.
Mm. Speaking with Dr. Scott Wright, he's an associate professor in the gerontology interdisciplinary program at the University of Utah, and Dr. Cheryl Wright, an associate professor in the Department of Family and Consumer Studies at the U, and they are both part of the iStar research project. It's this new exciting research that involves autism showing a promising connection with technology and how that can help children develop socially and meaningful relationships. So if you'd like to join our conversation, if you've got experience with a child with autism or have a child with autism in your classroom, what tools, technological or otherwise, are you using to help them develop bonds with their peers? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and today on the program, we're talking about some new research that shows that technology, computers, and video games, these tools are helping children with autism build confidence and to build friendships and relationships. And it's all based on something called the iStar Project. Joining us to talk about this research is Dr. Cheryl Wright. She's an associate professor in the Department of Family and Consumer Studies at the University of Utah. She's leading the iStar Research Project. Also with us, Dr. Scott Wright, an associate professor in the gerontology program at the U, also part of the iStar project. And if you'd like to join our conversation, what strategies are you using to help your child with autism develop socially and emotionally? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. You mentioned earlier, Cheryl, that and it's also in your article that parents with of children with autism, they're very concerned about the future mm-hmm. for the children. What does the future look like for children with autism right now?
I would say that we mentioned previously that unfortunately there are high rates of unemployment, and you've got to think that these particular individuals have a great deal of difficulty, like at a job interview, have problems with eye contact. Most people think they have quirky little, you know, behaviorisms. And so people that don't understand and there's not an awareness of autism, you know, it's hard for them to get past, you know, an interview stage. You know, we are really committed to trying to help these kids develop job skills, you know. Temple Grandin is supporting our program, and you know, her big issue is give them a way to demonstrate and show their talents and abilities. And we're looking at working with our kids on developing portfolios, and so that they can communicate with people by their skills. Let me show you what I can do. And a way, you know, it becomes a tool for communication, a springboard, an opportunity for them to interact with, you know, other people, you know, their peers, their family members, their social support groups, and what we call in a very authentic way. Hmm. We're not, you know, spending time prompting them to have appropriate social engagement, which is an important part. They have to learn some social skills, but this is really unprompted. social engagement. And that's what we're so excited about. It's like we're accepting them for who they are and just trying to bring to light their special abilities.
You mentioned, Scott, that that you had a core group of kids, all of them boys.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose boys for this particular research project?
That's a very good question. And if you look at the statistics of the rates of autism, boys are affected by a much greater degree than girls for many different reasons. It could be that the attention on the behavioral aspects with boys is much more noticeable. Girls might have more subtle symptoms. But as it turns out, there is perhaps this self-selection process where, and we are talking about SketchUp, a computer technology program, and that we have either come to associate as stereotyping, or we come to assume that we see boys, males being much more, having a high degree affinity with computer type-based skills. Although we have found where we have all boys in our workshops, we don't believe that that's necessarily true. We're going to open up our workshops and try to focus in on bringing in girls into the workshop to learn about computer technologies, which we think is very important. It's known as the STEM fields, S-T-E-M, so science, technology, engineering, math. There's a need for more representation for girls in those fields. But that's just the way it has unfolded. It's been all males with our workshops, but this is typically pretty consistent with other kinds of intervention programs across the United States.
Mm. You also selected high-functioning kids, high-functioning kids with autism to participate in the study. Do you think that you'd also have positive results with the average kid with autism, mm-hmm. Or even lower functioning children with autism? Mm-hmm. Cheryl?
Those are really good questions. You know, our subject base was high functioning. Most of the kids are in regular classrooms, but we're really interested in funding more workshops with a wider range of developmental abilities. And we're particularly interested in getting young girls into our program. And we'd love for somebody out there to help us fund a project specifically targeting young girls.
And also other underrepresented groups in terms of reaching out to Hispanic, African-American communities in terms of the use of this SketchUp technology. Because, again, most of our workshops have centered on males, and typically, like Cheryl said, with a very particular subset, verbal, higher functioning. But we just know, we think that this computer technology opportunity, because it is freeware, has the capability, the opportunity to reach out to various different kinds of communities, not only here in Utah, but iStar is also a national presence in Orlando, Florida, Boulder, Colorado, and into Oregon. So we're moving beyond the state of Utah.
Hmm. Can I make one comment about the high-functioning part? One of our parents brought it to our attention that when we say high-functioning, she's like, my kid struggles every day. And so it's really hard for me to think that he's in that category of high-functioning. Schools can be very difficult locations and settings for these kids that have difficulty with friendship making. And, you know, and schools don't often highlight their visual spatial talents. And I should say that, you know, we're talking about a group of kids. I mean, we don't want to stereotype. Not all kids on the spectrum are going to be interested in SketchUp or interested in technology. But we have found a core group of kids that are. And so we're just want to play to that those strengths and build this program so that we have opportunities for these kids to shine.
You mentioned the friendship deal. And in the study, parents really wanted their kids to develop real friendships. I mean, you know, have a buddy, and they'd enroll them in soccer or in an art class, and they just were not connecting with their peers. But the SketchUp sessions were so different. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, in what way were the interactions different from, say, a soccer clinic or an art class?
Mm-hmm. One of the things we found in our research is our families tried lots of things with their kids, and unfortunately, they were less than positive experiences. As a matter of fact, a lot of the parents would say that these kids had failure experiences with sports and other kinds of activities that they weren't good at. And I think it was really what made our program different was that, again, the term authentic friendships, similar peers, and we provided them with a tool, SketchUp, where they could actively, excitingly show everybody their work and their designs and communicate. It really became a wonderful social engagement tool.
Was that an essential part of the workshops? It wasn't just like, here's a lecture, learn a skill, but it was kind of a show and tell.
Yes.
That really made that brought the kids out of their little shell, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, and I should mention also a big part of our program is peer-to-peer teaching. So we minimize the lecture part because these kids don't like talking heads, and we have brief little lessons, and then we release them on the computers. They have work time. They have to be focused on SketchUp, and then that's where you see them jumping around. Somebody's like, you know, how to use the Orbit tool, and we'll say, okay, who can show John how to use the Orbit tool? And so we had them teach each other. That was a real powerful part of the program too. So it just provided lots of opportunities for these kids to have ability and strength.
And I guess, Scott, the component of this that really brings your work into it was the relationships in the family, and particularly with the grandparents. Mm-hmm. I mean, did the grandparents see these grandchildren in a different way after witnessing?
Yes. And during our interviews and focus groups with grandparents, it was very obvious that their primary concern. And they are there putting in the hours, they're there putting in the effort to help carpool, transport, to be involved. But their primary concern is about the future. What is going to happen to my grandchild? What are they going to do after they leave the school system? And it's interesting that there is a phrase that's used in the community and education system. It's called aging out. And aging out is the term to capture when the federally and state mandated guidelines, regulations for supporting children and youth comes to an end. And so these individuals are now transitioning into adulthood, and you could hear the grandparents all saying, what's going to happen? I'm very concerned about the welfare and future. So what, grandparents saying, what can I do right now? And so, yes, in when they saw the involvement, their attitudes, their outlook was reframed, and so they became even more involved in these workshops by making sure that their grandson showed up on time. It was going to be an active part of it. And like Cheryl mentioned earlier, here's one other benefit that we didn't even think about, was where grandparents were saying, you know, I am not a big technology fan. In fact, a lot of older adults are intimidated by the use of technology, but they said, I'm going to learn this. I'm going to become more involved, because if I want to stay engaged with my grandson, then I'm going to have to be more actively involved in it. And then the grandchildren, like Cheryl said, were helping them. Let me show you how to do this computer program with Skyping, with iPads and iPhones. And so there's this downstream, upstream, back and forth support that we think is very refreshing and positive. Mm.
You're both clearly excited and a little surprised by the results of this research. Any drawbacks, any limitations that the tools you thought, well, maybe we should rethink this, or in the interactions that you saw, Scott?
Well, I think we mentioned this earlier that SketchUp is just the beginning. So one of the things that we're very careful is that it's a portal. It's a beginning point. It's a computer technology tool to learn. But we see it as a springboard into other sorts of learning, skills, life skills. So we don't want to limit this to like SketchUp is this magic elixir. It's something that just, that's all that you need to transform an individual on the spectrum. Okay, it is not. The secret ingredients are what goes on with families and peer support and teachers and communities with technology as a catalyst. And that's the key. Because one thing we're not saying, everybody just download SketchUp and you'll see this magic transformation happen. No, the iStar project is about how you cultivate social support around the child, and then you see the magic happen. Then you have the talent shining through. So it's very contextual, and it's also very, it's all about the support that goes along with computers.
Our time is running short. I started this segment by saying one in 47 kids in Utah has autism spectrum disorder. I mean, that's a pretty frightening number if you think about it. Cheryl, what are the implications of the iStar project? I mean, what are the kind of the long-term goals of your research?
We're currently seeking funding so we can expand it to other families, other communities. We'd really love to have somebody in Utah step up. we've gotten demands to bring it to other parts of the country. But our long-range goals, we really want to work with these kids, start early. The children we worked with were from ages 8 to 18. We want to start when they are in elementary school. This is a really important developmental time, when they start realizing they're different from their peers. And so this is a great developmental period to show them that, yes, they might be different from their peers, but with autism can come some real important skills and talents. Mm. And so our kids, I mean, even some of our kids, I like being different. They know they're different. And so focusing on that ability has been really wonderful. Mm-hmm. I should say that one of the themes in our research was hope. Our families, you know, when the grandparents went to their the grandchildren's schools and saw them present to their peers, the grandparents were just so impressed with their skill and ability.
You mentioned off the air that you are looking to expand this, mm-hmm. and you've got a couple of workshops coming up.
We are going to offer a community seminar where we're going to teach families about SketchUp, and so we're going to encourage families to download SketchUp on laptops and come to the university. That's going to be Thursday, January 3rd at 6 p.m. on the university campus, and we'll provide more information on your site. Our website is www.istar.utah.edu, and you can find information about how to download SketchUp on there. It's got more information about our project. And so we encourage your listeners to go to the website, too.
Have you had some interest from schools, from teachers, on how to integrate this into their classroom? Because, again, the volume of children with autism it's everywhere. It's pervasive.
Yes.
It's not just for isolated families. Everybody knows someone.
Yeah.
Who's affected by autism.
Yes, we would encourage teachers to attend the seminar, too. We did have a school-based program. There are confines with, our school-based program. We only had 50 minutes with our kids, whereas when we bring them to the university, we work with them for at least 2 hours at a time. And, the computer labs at the schools weren't always the best, and it took a long time to download SketchUp and get the kids working. And so those were some of our challenges working within schools. We are very interested in expanding the program, with more school-based, settings. We think, the after-school aspect of it, where we have more time to work with the kids, we can involve the families, have them come see the presentations after school. That's kind of what we think is our best program design right now.
And Scott, you have hope for the future of this project, it sounds like.
Yes, and I think going back to Temple Grandin, she just visited Salt Lake just recently, and she's been an inspiration and supports the iStar project, but in the sense that her biggest concern is, again, the future, the transition from an education system to the occupational world for individuals on the spectrum. And her big concern is that there is talent, there is strength, there is ability, but if it's not packaged right, if it isn't presented well, or if an individual doesn't learn the social skills, these are the individuals that, like Cheryl mentioned earlier, there is high unemployment, and I should say underemployment, because, you know, buttering bread pans as your vocational career for some individuals is really a waste of talent. We're very concerned about the long haul, and the iStar project is about social skills and life skills, and that's going to be key for the future of individuals on the autism spectrum.
Pretty exciting stuff. Scott Wright, an associate professor in the gerontology department at the University of Utah. Scott, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
And Cheryl Wright, associate professor in the Department of Family and Consumer Studies, the head of the iStar Research Project. Cheryl, great to have you here. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
And again, they've got a community workshop coming up on January 3rd. We'll have full details on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, a black tie chemistry affair. The annual Faraday lectures are back. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Since 1981, the Department of Chemistry at the University of Utah has sponsored the Faraday Lectures, standing room only events where chemistry meets performance art. And today on the program, we're getting a sneak peek of this year's celebrated event and discussing how the lectures continue to inspire the next generation of chemists. And joining me in studio is Chuck White. He's dean of the Graduate School and a professor of chemistry at the University of Utah. And Dr. White, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jennifer. It's good to be here.
Also with us, Dr. Peter Armantrout. He's a distinguished professor of chemistry also at the University of Utah. And Dr. Armantrout, welcome to you.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Now, the Faraday Lectures are happening tonight and tomorrow, but the bad news is they're sold out. If you don't have tickets, you can see one of the older Faraday lectures on Utah Education Network's KUEN Channel 9, and we'll give you details on the screening times that are coming up. But if you'd like to join our conversation, if you've been to a Faraday lecture, do you have a favorite Faraday lecture moment? Why do you think the Faraday lectures remain so appealing year after year? You can join us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. So the University of Utah has been hosting the Faraday Lectures for quite a while. Describe your first Faraday Lecture for us, Peter Armantrout.
Well, Chuck and I started these 8 years ago, and so it's because of the history. Professor Ron Ragsdale and Dr. Jerry Driscoll had done it for over 25 years, so it was a moment to take over for this long heritage. So, but Chuck and I put our heads together and tried to come up with some of the best of the old and some new things as well, and it seems like it's continued the tradition in a nice way.
Mm. Chuck, why does the chemistry department do these? Why do you host these lectures?
Well, I do it just for the fun. You know, it's a tremendous blast for me and for also for Peter to do this every year, but we also do it as a way of reaching out to the community and trying to inspire young people to consider careers in science and in chemistry in particular. We put fun foremost in the reason that we do this, and if it ends up that we recruit some students to consider science, then that's just gravy.
Tell us who Michael Faraday was.
Oh, Michael Faraday was a common man, actually, in Britain, and he grew up and weaseled his way into the laboratory of Sir Humphrey Davy and joined the Royal Society as a gentleman scientist and professor. And for a long time offered these Christmas lectures as public lectures for people in London. And so when Ron and Jerry started the lectures here about 32 years ago, then it was really to continue that tradition that Michael Faraday had started in England of making science accessible to the public.
Mm. Peter, describe your outfit. What are you going to wear?
Well, because it harkens back then to the days of Michael Faraday back in the late 1800s, we have a full set of tux and tails, including top hat that we wear to give the proper spirit then for the event. So we're quite the duo, actually.
Peter Armantrout is with us. He's a distinguished professor of chemistry at the University of Utah. Also, Chuck White, dean of the graduate school and a professor of chemistry at the U. And they are presenting the annual Faraday Lecture. That's happening tonight and tomorrow at the University of Utah. Sadly, if you don't have tickets, you're out of luck. But you can watch one of the older Faraday Lectures that features Professors Ron Ragsdale and Jerry Driscoll that is being broadcast on UEN Channel 9 this Saturday, December 22nd at 11 a.m. And again on Christmas Eve and on Christmas Day. We'll have full details on our website, kcpw.org. If you'd like to join us, if you've been to a Faraday lecture, what's your favorite experiment to watch? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. In preparing, I watched a clip of Doctors Ragsdale and Driscoll doing a couple of experiments. One is, you know, blowing up a can, and they collapsed this it looked like a gas can. They collapsed it, and then they were able to expand it with some liquid nitrogen. Chuck White, what are some of the experiments that you will be showing people as they go to the lecture today and tomorrow?
So it happens that Peter does exactly that demonstration during one of the segments. In one of my segments, I do a lecture which is modeled on one of the original lectures that Michael Faraday gave on the chemical history of a candle. Mm. So we explain just how candles work and some of the things that are a little bit unexpected about the way the candles work. But in the last segment, my research area is in explosives, and so we blow some stuff up.
Oh,
and that's fun.
Blowing up. Is that always the highlight?
Well, it is for me.
It's the last segment, too. So it does culminate in that.
Save the best for last. You've been doing this together, this dog and pony show, for about 8 years.
Right.
I mean, what keeps you going back, Peter?
It as Chuck said, I mean, it's the audience really gets into it. And the highlight for me is at the end of the lecture, the kids that will come down and just ask more questions about how you did this, or, you know, how did this work, or, you know, people will pick up. At one point, we freeze a ball and then explode that using very cold, using liquid nitrogen. Smash that against the wall, and there are usually little bits and pieces that are left over. Children will pick those up as a you know, a souvenir of the lecture. So there's a lot of excitement then, and it's a real joy.
Mm. Has doing the lectures changed the way your classroom operates? I mean, your day-to-day lecturing as a professor, Peter?
I'd say not really, although it does bring home the fact that the more you can get people to participate in the classroom, the better, the more real it is, the more they're engaged in the process. And the lectures, I think, then emphasize that in a tremendous way.
Mm. Chuck White, I mean, why don't we see more chemistry professors showing that science can be really fun and entertaining and, you know, hoping to influence the next generation in the way that you are through these Faraday lectures?
Well, I think you're seeing more and more of this all the time. There are faculty members and actually people in industry also who are becoming more engaged in public outreach, talking about science, and just really showing people how a basic knowledge of science is really essential for understanding the world and understanding, you know, things like global warming and the ozone layer and things like that. So science is really important for making everyday decisions in our lives, and scientists are getting out there more and showing people the wonders of science and the fun of science.
Mm. So you see this as outreach And a little bit of entertainment, a little performance in there too?
Yes. So one of the things that we do is for the performance aspects, we concentrate on making things fun. So we turn things different colors, we blow things up, and it's all sort of whiz-bang at the front of the lecture hall. But what we also do is we have a PowerPoint show that's running simultaneously, and that explains some of the background, some of the chemical reactions that are going on. And so people can have their choice. They can either just watch the whiz-bang that's going on at the ground level, or they can glance up at the PowerPoint and see what the chemical reactions are and a little bit deeper behind the demonstration. So both things are there.
We include a little bit of that as we go along, too.
Who's your target audience? Is it the kids or is it the parents who can also help motivate the kids? Who's the target?
Yes and yes.
So we welcome boys and girls of all ages, but the basic outreach is to the kids.
Mm. These lectures consistently sell out. And I should mention the lectures are free,
yes,
but it's a limited number of seats, about 350. You do require tickets. It's tough to snag these. Any thought of taking this to a larger venue, Peter?
It turns out that I have a friend. I introduced these lectures actually at the University of Pacific in Sacramento, and a friend has now taken them over. So I did them once there, sort of a short version, and he now does it in their basketball arena. By
wow.
the same token, it is true that they're sort of intimate experiments. And so being able to, if you're in the back row of the basketball arena, your ability to appreciate what's going on is less. We do hold it in the largest lecture hall that we have available in chemistry. And we do two shows, which wear us out completely. And we did try three shows one year, and that was definitely a lot. And occasionally we do put them on at other times of the year upon special requests. And people should know that selling out, again, you mentioned that they are free, but people are welcome to contact the University Chemistry Department at the beginning of October in order to get tickets. It's also true that even though they're sold out, there are often some people that don't show up. And so if somebody's really interested in a small group, they can always stop by and see whether or not there might be a couple of spare seats.
Okay. Well, you said it. I didn't say it.
No.
We're speaking
with Peter. Could be dangerous.
Peter
no
Armentrout.
Guarantees.
Peter Armentrout is a distinguished professor of chemistry at the University of Utah. Chuck White, dean of the grad school and professor of chemistry also at the University of Utah. They will be presenting the Faraday lectures tonight and tomorrow. You can also see a screening of the older Faraday lectures by Professors Ron Ragsdale and Jerry Driscoll to be broadcast on UEN Channel 9 this Saturday morning at 11 o'clock. That's December 22nd. Also at 8 p.m. on Christmas Eve, Monday, December 24th, and at 5 a.m. on Tuesday, December 25th. I guess that's for those Santas out there who need a little lift. We've only got about a minute left or so. Professor White, you're leaving the University of Utah to become the new president of Weber State. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
How are you feeling as this may be your last Faraday performance?
Well, it's a little bittersweet. And, you know, I've been at the University of Utah Chemistry Department for 28 years now. And that's a long time. I've been cleaning out my office this week, and there's a lot of stuff that collects over 28 years. But, you know, Peter and I agree that the Faraday lecture tradition will go on for sure next year, and maybe at Weber State. No firm decisions have been made there, but I think we'd like to try to expand this a little bit and bring the fun of science to even more people next year.
That's what I was going to ask. Is Weber State going to adopt this tradition?
We haven't made any firm decisions, but I think there are perhaps some people in the chemistry or physics department there who'd be interested in embarking on this adventure. It's a lot of fun.
What do you hope people walk away with tonight and tomorrow, Peter?
It's a combination, I think, of, you know, that science really is fun. Chemistry is fun. It's enjoyable there, but that also that there's some wonders in the world that scientists have begun to really understand and can share with people. So that combination, I think, so that the awe and mystery of nature and our understanding of it, and the excitement then of the discovery of actually how things work, which is one of the things that we try to share in the lectures. Mm.
Dr. Peter Armantrout, a distinguished professor of chemistry at the University of Utah. Peter, thanks so much for the time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Chuck White, dean of the grad school, at least for a few more days, and professor of chemistry at the University of Utah. Dr. White, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Jennifer.
And Drs. Armantrout and White will be presenting the Faraday Lectures tonight and tomorrow at the University of Utah. And you can see some old Faraday Lectures on UEN Channel 9. We'll have full details on our website, kcpw.org. And as Dr. Armantrout mentioned, if you want tickets for next year, call the Department of Chemistry next October. Coming up tomorrow, the tech sector in Utah. What's hot and who's hiring? So join us for that. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.